debate going on. And so we had discussed, for one thing in that connection, the question of the antiquity of man, and we asked what to say about that by looking at the genealogies in Genesis 5 and 11, and concluding that these genealogies were incomplete, that there was an element of discontinuity. We simply took the position that there the Bible itself does not compel us to adopt any particular view with respect to the antiquity of man, and it leaves us open for to accommodate the valid findings of science in that regard. And now, then we moved on from there to the question of the age of the cosmos, which is another a big area of dispute, of course. And we had time, I think, last week just to set forth what are the generally recognized as the three major views. For example, right now I'm sort of indirectly involved in a book which is being produced to present these three views. There are three authors, and in the case of the other two views, they're co-authors. In the case of the view I'm involved with, I'm a consultant. But in any case, the three views that will be dealt with in this particular book, I don't know, it'll probably be 4, 5, 6 months before it is out, are then the days are solar days, that the days represent ages, each one. And then there was the third view that usually has come to be known as the framework interpretation, and would have been the least familiar to you, and so we spent a little time trying to sketch out what it was. But very quickly then, just reviewing, you all know then that the literal view, the first view, holds, and that we have to do here in this picture of a week in Genesis with six regular solar days plus the seventh, the Sabbath. And the second view then holds that what is that the Hebrew word, I guess, that they would insist should be translated age, and so that the picture that is formulated there in Genesis 1 would not be that of just a week of regular days, but it would be a week of ages, and with an attempt made to show that there is a correspondence. How successfully, I doubt, but an attempt is made to show that there would be a correspondence between the six ages of Genesis 1 and a succession of geological eras. So that would be the second view. And then there was the third view, which is, as I said, the framework interpretation. Now, the second and the third views are both figurative. The second view, the day-age view, takes the matter of duration and says that it can be handled figuratively, so the days can be stretched as to their duration instead of taken literally. On the framework interpretation, the principle of figurativeness impacts the thing in such a way that it is not just a question of the duration of the time that could be understood figuratively, but also, and this is the distinctive feature of the framework view, it would hold that the narrative sequence is not intended to correspond to the actual chronological sequence. There was, of course, a period of time, whatever it was. It's real historical chronology. But the narrative sequence is not designed then to portray the actual historical sequence. That's the view, and that we developed the view. And I tried to show that the actual narrative sequence is a matter of theme, an interest in various themes, rather than just driving ahead in terms of straightforward chronology. And now, earlier in our lesson last week, we had been looking at the total structure of the book of Genesis, and we had already discovered there that the whole book of Genesis is structured in such a way that instead of following straightforward chronology from beginning to end, that it is set up in such a way that after the prologue, which is the creation story we're now concerned with, but after the prologue, the whole book of Genesis was divided into 10 sections, and that these 10 sections then were arranged in interesting patterns which reflected a concern to achieve certain numbers like triads. So there are groupings of the 10 sections of Genesis that produce triads or pairs and so on. And more to our present point, what we discovered was that here in the first section, for example, it treats the entrance and the escalation of sin into the world from the actual fall of man up to the time of the flood. So the first chapters there, 2, 3, and 4, take you all the way up to that period. And then instead of proceeding along in a straightforward chronological line, another theme is picked up. This was the story of the line of Cain, the line of the city of man. Then, having gotten up to the flood, you go back in chapter 5, verse 1, and you go through that whole history again, once again from Adam up to the flood, but now from the point of view not of the line of Cain, but of the line of Seth, which is the account then of the community of faith, city of man, community of faith. Same thing happens here in the fourth section, the table of nations, the city of man, and then in the fifth section, the line of Shem, the community of faith. So Moses, the author, has this particular style that he arranges things thematically. He treats one theme up to a certain point, okay, then he backs up, treats another theme. Now, the framework interpretation suggests that that's what's going on in Genesis 1, where, again, things are divided into triads, plus the climactic seventh, and you follow along with one theme, namely the various kingdoms that God created, the spheres of creation, the kingdoms, and that's the theme here. And then the second 3 days, 4, 5, and 6, pick up another theme. And interestingly, and this will be one of the points we'll underscore in a few minutes, when you come to day 4, you find yourself repeating day 1. Exactly the same things are produced on day 4 as are on day 1. So chronologically, you know, you're back there. But thematically now, what you have in days 4, 5, and 6 is the story of the kings who ruled over the kingdoms. They get up to the story of man and how he ruled over everything, that he's a priest under God, and he delivers his kingdom subdued unto the great king of the seventh day, the Lord of the Sabbath. Well, so that very quickly then may serve to identify the framework interpretation, which is then another figurative view. Now, how to get at this, let me say this first. The view that I will be advocating, I guess by now you understand it, would be the framework interpretation that I'm advocating. This view agrees with the literal view that what is being portrayed is ordinary days with their evenings and mornings. That's the language. That's the picture that's being portrayed. Those who hold to a solar day, I don't think, are right. It isn't that this thing called in Hebrew a yom should be translated an age. No, these are regular days. That is right. That is what the picture is. But the question is this picture of a week of normal days, is this picture as a whole, we're not just talking about an individual word, the word yom or something else here, but is this total picture to be understood literally, or is the whole thing a figure? And now that's the real question, I think, and what I would hope to proceed to do is to show that this picture of a normal week is not to be understood literally, but figuratively, how to compare it. Let's say here's the parable of the sower. Here's the parable of the sower. Now, if you ask, what is the actual literal picture there? Well, the literal picture is the farmer goes out and with actual seed, and he sows the seed, and so forth. Is that what Jesus is talking about? Is he talking about agriculture? No, literally, that's the picture, all right. But the question, the exegetical question for the whole piece is what's the nature of this this piece, this genre? Is it intended as a whole to be understood literally, or is it a parable? And now in the case of the sower, we know, yeah, Jesus is not talking about agriculture. He's talking about the Son of God going forth and preaching the Word of God. Now, that's not literally what the text says, but that's what contextual considerations tell you is going on. So one question is, what is the literal picture? It is a week of days. But the bigger question is that intended to be understood figuratively or not? Now let me give you a series of arguments to show that that literal picture is intended to be understood for something else, just as the parable of the sower, the farmer sowing the seed, is given as a picture intended to convey the truth about the preaching of the gospel and so on. Now the first thing along that line that I would cite as evidence that these days are intended to be understood figuratively is the seventh day. Seventh day, the Sabbath day, the Lord's Sabbath day, his rest. And how long did that one last? Well, of course, it's still going on, isn't it? In the nature of the case, what is the nature of God's Sabbath rest? God's Sabbath rest is that when he has consummated his work, and he has created the heavens and then the earth, the heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool, when he has created this cosmic temple, this cosmic throne for himself, he takes his throne. He takes his place on his heavenly throne. The Sabbath is the enthronement of the one who has consummated his work of creation. He takes his position as the one who has finished the work, as the one who is sovereign over it, as the one who rules in majesty over all the works of his hand. When did he stop doing that? 24 hours after he started? Obviously not, or a month later? No. I mean, God's Sabbath rest, God's Sabbath status as the Sabbath God who is enthroned over his consummated creation, in the nature of the case, this is unending, and the proof of the pudding exegetically, if just the nature of the case didn't settle it, is in what we read elsewhere in the scripture about that Sabbath. And now, maybe I won't take time to look up many things because there's so much to try to get in here that we have to keep sailing along. But in Hebrews 4, you can look it up now for yourselves. In Hebrews 4, we have the discussion of the Sabbath. And the readers are reminded, you know, of how Joshua in the Old Testament led the people into their Sabbath land. And so what the Sabbath signifies was the consummated kingdom of God was being prototypically portrayed there in Israel's experience of entering into the land. So Joshua led them into the Sabbath land. But that wasn't the real one, the author of Hebrews then quickly reminds us. That wasn't the real one. The real Sabbath one is the one that is still out there. And in this connection, he quotes now from Genesis 2 about God's seventh day. So he quotes from Genesis 2. This is the thing that he is explaining and expounding, God's seventh rest. And what he says is that, look, you believers in the Lord Jesus, this is where you're heading. God has entered into, from the beginning, into that Sabbath rest, and that Sabbath is going on. Heaven is there, the Sabbath is there, they're all in place. Here we are on earth, and we're making our earthly journey in terms of the covenant as God sets up the way whereby we can get up there into heaven to his Sabbath rest with him. And in Christ, this is being fulfilled as the Old Testament Joshua wasn't able to do it. Jesus is doing the real thing, and he's leading us into that real Sabbath rest, into that seventh day of God. So Hebrews 4 expounds God's seventh day of creation and says that it is the goal, it's the telos, it's the toward which we are moving, and it goes on forever. Now that's the seventh day. And that's the best clue you have then as to what the nature of these days is. One of them certainly is not a literal day. It had a beginning, but it has no end. There's one of them. Now, maybe in this connection I could cite something which is usually appealed to as one of the strongest arguments for a literal view. It's over against a figurative one, namely the fourth commandment. So when you turn to Exodus 20 and verse 11, you turn to verse 20:11, you remember, of course, there that Sabbath observance in terms of working 6 days and resting the seventh day, the ordinance of the Sabbath, which is assigned to mankind. I qualify that a little bit. It's assigned to mankind within the covenant. We'll talk more about the Sabbath later on. But the ordinance of the Sabbath is there based squarely on the fact that God worked 6 days and he rested the seventh. Therefore, you work 6 days and rest the seventh. Now then, the point of the objection to my approach or to any figurative view is it is assumed that there must be a one-to-one relationship between the original and the copy. God worked 6 days and rested the seventh. Therefore, you work 6 days and rest the seventh. Now, our working 6 days and resting the seventh, we know is normal solar days. And the argument is there must be a one-to-one relationship, otherwise this doesn't make any sense. If God's days are not literal ones, then there is no copy. Now, that's a false assumption. What we're talking about here is a likeness. And with the likeness, there is similarity, but also difference. Now, before we're done, we hope to be showing how there's a whole series of things whereby the realities of heaven are copied on earth. That's a very important theme that we're going to be, that the reality of heaven as the heavenly temple is replicated here on earth. God, his nature is replicated in Adam, who is made in the image of God. All right, let's take that one. Adam is made in the image of God. There's the original and there's a copy. There's likeness. And that's what justifies calling Adam the image of God. There's likeness, but with a big difference. Likewise, not just with the nature of man, that he is like God, but with a difference, but in man's activity. Man's activity, his working 6 days and resting the seventh, that is like God, but with a difference in each case. And so the assumption that there must be a one-to-one relationship between the two things is simply false. And what proves it is Hebrews 4, because we already have seen that there is not a one-to-one relationship when you come to the seventh day. God's seventh day is forever. The weekly ordinance of the Sabbath is 24 hours. So there is likeness between the two, but with a difference, we know, with respect to the seventh day. So what you usually hear as a big argument for insisting on a literal view, which one of the two main arguments I hear most against a figurative view, it doesn't say that at all, and in fact it points us in the opposite direction. It leads us to recognize that God's seventh day was eternally, therefore it is a figure in Genesis 1, or actually Genesis 2 verses 1 through 3. So there is one point. Now I might have prefaced that. I jumped right into a first argument for treating this picture of a week of days figuratively. I might have begun with just a general comment, and I'll do it quickly. Where do you expect figures of speech? In prose, poetry? Well, you can have them in either, can't you? You can encounter a figure of speech in any prose, but you'd expect more of it in poetry, and so you get more figures of speech in poetry. And so for what it's worth, it's worth noting then that the creation narrative is formed in a way which would be difficult to say is just ordinary prose. It has many striking features of poetry. Poetry is created in stanzas, which have a certain format that keeps being repeated. It has certain refrain lines, initial lines, closing lines, refrain lines that keep getting repeated. Various other features of Semitic poetry might be mentioned. And now when you look at Genesis 1 and 2 of the creation narrative, what you right away realize is that the formalized structure of the thing, it's like six stanzas, the six work days, six stanzas, each one with the same basic format, fiat, let there be, and it was so, fulfillment. And so there is this arrangement of six blocks of material. It's just not strung out in some indefinite kind of paragraphs, but the thing is shaped in these six stanzas, these six strophes, all with the same form, fiat fulfillment, let there be and there was. And then interspersed throughout the strophes, there are all kinds of refrains. Now, I don't know if I read through them, you know, it'll ring bells. And God said, let there be, and it was so. And God separated this from that. And God made, and God named, and God blessed. God saw that it was good. And it was evening and morning, day, whatever. Now, if you just underline all of those refrains, which, you know, each of them appears several times, you will have taken up most of the material in the narrative. And so here we have something which is written in sort of poem style, with stanzas, with refrains, other things could be mentioned. One striking feature of Semitic Hebrew poetry is what is known as the parallelism of clauses, where you say something, and then you say virtually the same thing all over again in synonyms, and it produces a certain logical balance and sometimes a certain rhythmic or meter balance, a quantitative balance that gives at least the appearance of meter. But the synonymous parallelism, especially the balance of clauses, the repetition of a particular thought. And now you don't need that feature to have genuine poetry. For example, take the Song of Solomon, the Song of Songs, certainly beautiful poetry, and about only 50% of the lines in the Song of Song have this particular feature of this kind of poetic balance. So you don't need this in order for the thing to qualify as poetry, but it is a striking feature. And in Genesis 1, you might note then that this poetic feature is used sparingly, but it is used very effectively. It's used only twice, but it's used at the two climax points, so that here is this particular poetic device, and the author has saved it in order to highlight the two climax points in his narratives. What would you say is the first highlight in the thing? I would think certainly when you come up then to the creation of man, that's the first climax of the story, the crown of creation under God. And there, what's it, Genesis 1:27, I guess it is, where it says, and so he created man in his own image, yes, in the image of God created he him. So the thought is restated, and not even in synonymous terms, virtually the same terms. And then the ultimate climax is certainly when you come to the seventh day, and there, I guess it would be the Genesis 2, verse 2, where it says, and so God completed everything that he made. Yes, he completed all that he had made. So, all right. Now, all I'm trying to say then is that as you look at this record, you should come to the conclusion that this is poetic. And now, this doesn't settle the question. All it does is this, though, that you shouldn't be so surprised if this is a piece of poetically flavored material. You shouldn't be so surprised if it should turn out that there are some figures in it, such as we are suggesting is the case with the chronological refrain. It was evening and it was morning, day one. It was evening, it was morning, day two, and so on. So this, it just sets us up so we shouldn't be too hostile to the thought of figures of speech. Now, in that connection, however, let me just add this further word of explanation, because one is very often misunderstood in this regard. I know when about 30 years ago I wrote an article on this subject for the Westminster Theological Journal, and we might refer to this later on, it was called Because It Had Not Rained. And in that article I made something like the point I just made to you, that this material was sort of poetic and therefore could be considered as figurative, that my good colleague E.J. Young, my senior colleague in the Old Testament department, who didn't hold to the view I'm advocating, but to one of the others, whichever, I'm not quite sure which he held to, he sort of, I'm not quite sure whether he actually accused me of it or not, but he at least was cautioning people that if you hear that the material is poetic, that you shouldn't buy into the notion that it was non-historical. As if to say that something was poetic and figurative meant that you were denying the historicity of the thing. Now, that doesn't follow. I do say that it is figurative, but I say that it is a very much historical. For example, in Exodus 14 and 15, you have two accounts of the crossing of the sea, the great salvation event there in the Old Testament. In Exodus 14, you have the prose account. In Exodus 15, you have the poetic account. No one doubts, or at least you know, those who believe the Bible, no one doubts that the Exodus 15, the Song of Moses, is actually an account of the history, but it isn't poetry. And when you come right to the big event, Exodus 14 speaks about God caused an east wind to blow all night long, and so there's an appeal to certain natural secondary causes that might have come into play that God used in order to dry up the waters for the passage of his people through. Now, when you come to that same point in the poem, you get a tremendously strong anthropomorphic figure there saying that by the blast of his nostrils, God dried up the waters. No more east wind talk over here. That was a very strong figure of speech. Non-historical? No, absolutely historical, but very strong figure of speech. So I don't want people here listening to me think that I'm denying the historicity of these. No, absolutely, this is real historical stuff, just like the crossing of the sea, real historical stuff. But real history can be described in poetic ways, and that's the question then we must face. What's the evidence for it? So I looked at the seventh day, and I said, there's one of them. There's one of the 7 days that is not literal by the Bible itself. It is figurative. And now, let's see, maybe along the line I might be making some use here of an article that I wrote more recently, as I just said, about 30 years ago. I guess it was back in 1957. Wow, how time flies, doesn't it? That's more, it's more than 30 years ago. I hate to think how long ago I wrote that other article then. Okay, here's what I wrote more recently, March 1996, in Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith. And the title of the article was Space and Time in the Genesis Cosmogony, an account of the origin of the cosmos. And that's what we're talking about here, God's account of the origin of the universe. Space and Time in the Genesis Cosmogony. So I might from time to time be reading from that if you're interested in seeing the whole article. That's where you would find it then.
Where is that?
It's Perspectives on Science. It used to be the Journal of the American Scientific Affiliation. It still is. The magazine that's put out by them. And the editor of it is Jack Hawes, who's one of the elders in our OP church in North Jordan, Massachusetts. If I do make use of it, I'll be reading from a typed copy that I had of my own here. All right. In this particular, yes, please.
Is part of our problem in understanding Genesis that is that the church as a whole, do they have a misunderstanding because they don't understand the intended reader and the time it was written? Was this not understood by those who lived in that first century.
Yeah, it's hard to appeal to how people back there understood the thing because we don't know how they understood the thing. And all we can do is try to use honest principles of biblical exegesis to find out what they should have understood by it. We always run into this problem. For example, if you're talking about messianic prophecies, well, we know what they should have thought of about them. What, for example, Jesus in Luke 24, when he expounded all about Messiah's sufferings and glory and Moses and the prophets and the south, they should have understood what Jesus said they meant, but of course they didn't. So I don't know what they actually understood, and all I can try to do is to try to find some biblical evidence as to what they and we should understand by these things. Now, part of it, of course, has to do with having some sensitivity to the literary styles and so on, of course, of the ancient world, and that will certainly help us, and to have a certain modesty about approaching it, that we don't already know everything about that. Yeah. The Sabbath, then, we've discussed, and then that already reminds us then that there are two levels to reality. In this article, I talk about the upper and lower register. There's that seventh day, God's seventh day, which is an eternal thing. And what does it consist in? Well, we've already said it consists in God taking his throne in heaven, creator of the whole world, in an unending Sabbath rest, invisible to us now, but with the invitation one day that we're going to get there into that Sabbath seventh day, which is invisible to us because it's part of that heavenly realm, which has dimensions of that we cannot penetrate with our present earthly bodies. The day will come when we are glorified and we have new capabilities and so on, and so what is now invisible to us will be opened up to us, and it will put a new face on the whole world so that it becomes to us a new heaven and a new earth. But there is that invisible realm of heaven up above. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. What's Jesus talking about there? He's talking about the two registers, huh? Mm-hmm. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven where God is enthroned in the midst of his angels, unseen to us, the invisible realm, the upper register, the invisible, that's all we're talking about. It's over against this earthly realm to which, until our glorification, we are limited. So the seventh day reminds us of these two levels, because up there's the divine original, that ongoing thing which is forever, but then down here, the ordinance of the Sabbath. And well, I've already taken the position then that there in Genesis 2, verses 2 and 3, there you have the ordinance of the Sabbath. The Sabbath, as I understand it, is a creation ordinance. The ordinance of the Sabbath, what we are supposed to do, work six literal days and rest the seventh day. The ordinance of the Sabbath brings us down here to the lower register. And all the way through this thing, there's going to be replication. What's going on up there as it's copied down here. And so I want to develop that, and I might have said this as an introductory word. So here we're dealing with this whole thing in terms of that one problem of the days of Genesis and the chronology. But I want our study to be more positive than that, and so while we're at this, I'm trying also to bring out the positive teaching of Genesis 1, and I think I can interlock the two discussions so that we don't get lost along the way. But so what we're doing now is trying to give you some insight into the teaching of Genesis 1 about the nature of the cosmos. I think Christian people are a lot more interested in that kind of thing, the nature of the whole cosmos, especially as modern science gives us some beginnings of an understanding of the vastness of it and the questions about its origin and its future, whether it's heading for the big crunch or whether it's a stability or whatever. But people are interested in that, and I think the Bible has things to say about it, and it's a subject that deserves more attention than it gets. Let's just say a little bit about it here. And let's go back to work right through from Genesis 1, right back to the Sabbath day. And as I said repeatedly, we're going to see that God has structured the cosmos in such a way that heavenly realities serve as archetypes which reproduce themselves in copies here in earthly existence of all kinds that keeps happening. But now, Genesis 1 then, verse 1. In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. So we have in the beginning. You can read that, can't you? In the beginning, that says, all right. And then heaven and earth. All right? Original Sabbath, copy of the Sabbath down here. All right. Heaven, earth. All right, my contention is going to be, we will, as we look at this presently, is that heaven in Genesis 1:1 is not describing the visible sky up there, but it's describing the invisible heaven. As we just said in the Lord's Prayer, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That's the heaven and earth contrast that you have in Genesis 1:1 already. Genesis 1:1 is saying that in the beginning, God made everything invisible, heaven and earth visible. All right. But now before we get to that, we have the expression in the beginning. And especially in connection with this problem of the days of Genesis, we're interested in that timeline up there. The thing that begins with in the beginning and ends with Sabbath day up in that upper register, not down on this lower literal register down here, but up there. And of course, this line of argument is going to end up by showing that the 6 days, the foreman is about, it was morning and it was evening day, 1 day, 2 days, 3, and so on. The 6 days, of course, are bracketed by these beginning and ending points, which have to do with the upper register, with the original, not with the literal day of the Sabbath ordinance, but with the thing for which that is a figure up there. That's where these 6 days fit in. Now, likewise, in the beginning, what is the in the beginning? Let's see. Let me just read a spec from that article. I see the heading there is upper register time, the beginning. As observed above, the allusions in Proverbs 8, now we're going to get to Proverbs 8, it's a fascinating thing. In Proverbs 8, I think you have the first interpretation of Genesis 1, and Solomon, or whoever is writing there, Proverbs 8, believed in the framework interpretation, because he expounds Genesis 1 in terms of it here, and probably we'll get back to that in a minute. But the allusions in Proverbs 8 to the in the beginning, Bereshit, of Genesis 1:1, show that this beginning precedes the situation surveyed in Genesis 1:2 and following. It stands at the head of the creation days. While belonging to the creation week, it marks, now, in the beginning, what is that? What other passages in the Bible, of course, do you think of right away? Well, here, I'm suggesting, in the beginning, while belonging to the creation week, marks the interface of pre-creation and the space-time continuum. Pointing back, in the beginning, pointing back to what is signified by was in the identification of God as the one who is and who was and who is to come. In the beginning is that God who was, now he is, and he is to come. In Genesis 1:1, the beginning is peculiarly associated with God himself. In the beginning, God created. Likewise, echoes of the Hebrew word Bereshit, in the beginning, in the scriptures, focus on divine acts and intra-Trinitarian relationships back of creation. In the beginning has to do, I'm trying to say, with the upper register here, not with this lower register. It has to do with the heavenly scene, not the so much the earthly scene. It has to do with divine acts and intra-Trinitarian relationships back of creation, equating the beginning with the stage before the earth was, as we'll see in a moment. Proverbs 8:23 asserts that the personified divine wisdom was present with God at the beginning. The divine wisdom personified was present with God there at the beginning. The prologue of John's Gospel, which I suppose is the one we all think of right away when we're trying to think of a in the beginning. The prologue of John's Gospel identifies the beginning in terms of the relationship between God and the Logos, who was God and made all things, the one who identifies himself as the beginning of the creation of God and speaks of the glory that he had with the Father before the world was. So all the indicators tell us that in the beginning belongs to that upper register where Father, Son, and Spirit act together in sovereign purpose and word and power to create the world. In the beginning is a time coordinate of invisible space. So the story begins then by putting us up in heaven. The account of creation isn't told from the point of view of someone on earth. It's told from the perspective of God in heaven. In the beginning, there is God. He is the one who proceeds to act. He is the one who, at the end of the thing, is enthroned in this world which he has created. And this is the perspective of the passage. In the beginning, has that flavor, and as I said, Proverbs 8 is a good place to find out just exactly what in the beginning means. Some people have said that in the beginning describes the whole period of the 6 days of creation. That was the beginning period. Now, what I've just been arguing is that in the beginning is not the equivalent of the whole time span of creation, but it belongs there to the initial chunk of time. If you're trying to figure out, turns out, how much time was involved, and if you accept something like the modern estimate of the cosmos as being on the order of some 12 billion or so years old, actually this beginning period lasted for billions of years. According to Proverbs 8, it describes the period before those developments which begin to be described in Genesis 1, verse 2. Now, when you come to Genesis 1, verse 2, you have to do with a planet Earth that exists in a certain condition of deep and darkness, which, as the days move along, gets structured. First, the waters, then the darkness gets structured by the introduction of light into a cycle of day and night. And then the waters get structured horizontally and vertically as you move along. But here now, according to Proverbs 8, in the beginning is the period before you come to that stage. What is it? The Earth is supposed to be about 5 billion years old. So if the universe is 12 billion years old, in the beginning it's covered about 7 billion years. But forget that. If you don't buy into that, at least in the beginning, describes that chunk of time before you come to where Genesis 1-2 describes the situation of planet Earth as being in such and such a condition. Now, yes?
Sir, I know the limiter, in the beginning of the seventh day, their upper register. Are the days then of creation itself then?
That of course is the conclusion I'm wanting to come to. Is of course that the 6 days can't be separated from the seventh day. They belong to that series. Right? So if the seventh day is up there, that already settles that the 6 days that are linked to them must also be. But then I'm also trying to show that it's very difficult to disassociate in the beginning from that time. So really, the 6 days are bracketed by two things that put you up in the upper register. And ergo, the 6 days must be up there. That's the argument. Okay. And you might have fun to turn to Proverbs 8 with me now. It's a wonderful passage here. In the opening nine chapters of Proverbs, you keep reading about this woman wisdom. And she is extolled and she is commended to everyone to receive this woman. And she is set over against the false woman, the harlot. So don't go after the harlot whose ways lead down to death, but follow this woman, and her ways are the ways of life. And so you get that personified divine wisdom through these opening chapters. And then when you come here in Proverbs 8, you have a wonderful sort of, we talk about poetry. Huh? In Genesis 1, the poetic feature is limited to certain the chronological details, maybe one or two other things. Here you have a beautiful piece of poetry throughout, and it tells us about the role that wisdom, why should we be so eager to embrace and to follow wisdom? Well, she says, look at who I am and what I did. So wisdom commends herself to us in terms of the role that she played in connection with the creation. You're impressed by the wonders of creation, are you? Well, then you should be impressed with me because, look, I was there when all that was happening. And then the punchline at the end, I was not only there, but I was the architect. This is one that boss man should like here. Yeah. He's an Amun, he's an architect, and that's what wisdom says. Let's look at it. Beginning with verse 22, Proverbs 8:22. Get our Bibles out here. And what we're going to be finding here is that business of theme. Theme and recapitulating chronologically after you're done with a certain theme.